Hello, and welcome to the Slongcast, episode 10 for Monday, July 19th, 2010. I am your host, Kevin Slonka, here as always, and with me this week, Ryan Lancey.
Hey, how's everyone doing?
All right. And we actually have a studio audience this week. He's sitting here watching. You know, maybe he'll be on a future show. I'm not going to say his name in case he decides not to be on a future show, but we have somebody in studio, so we got a full studio today. Got a lot of good stuff to talk about. Biggest thing we're going to talk about is all of the hard data about the iPhone 4 antenna problem. But we're going to save that for last. Save the best for last. Got a lot of interesting stuff to talk about beforehand. So the first thing that I saw, which was actually really cool, it was a presentation given by a Google engineer talking about the real-life social network. And what they mean by that, they're basically comparing kind of their thoughts on Google Me, that's the name of it, right? Google Me, their new social network. Have you heard about that?
I actually haven't.
Yeah, so Google's coming out with their own version of Facebook, pretty much. They haven't really talked about it that much. Kevin Rose broke the story when he kind of leaked it a couple weeks ago. But Google's coming out with their own. We don't know when. And this presentation pretty much goes over some of their thoughts and how they're going to make it different from Facebook. So it's 216 slides. I mean, it's a huge presentation. We're not going to talk about all of them. But a couple of the points in here are really good, and I really hope that Google implements these. So just the main idea of this is that the way Facebook works, everybody in our social network is one big bubble. Even though in our real lives, you know, as the person in this presentation, she has her friends from LA, she has her friends from San Diego, she has her friends from swimming and the kids that her kids play around with, and she has her family. And in real life, those are four separate social, in air quotes, social networks, and they don't interact at all in real life. But because she uses Facebook, they interact. And that's a bad thing because some of her friends from LA work at a gay bar and they post pictures, you know, from the nights whenever fun stuff happens onto her page. And because they do that, the kids that she's friends with from the swimming pool and her family can see this, and this is not a good thing. So basically, Google realizes that the social networking tool that they come out with has to be more like real life. There has to be a way to define your internal social networks and keep them separate. So what do you think about that whole idea?
Well, I mean, doesn't Facebook, you know, have some kind of, there's permissions, right? So if somebody posts something on your profile, you can restrict who sees those things.
I don't know about restricting other people's posts. You can restrict your own post.
Well, I know you can prevent people from posting at all.
Right, you can do that.
To your wall.
Yeah. I know you can't do anything after the fact, because I have already, like, posted things to my site, and the permissions have been wrong. Facebook screwed them up, and I couldn't go back and change them to let people see it.
Right.
Like, there was this one time I was in New York for a bus trip. The whole day I was posting, you know, I'm here doing this, you know, check out this picture, this is awesome. And my parents actually called me when I was sitting down eating dinner, like, are you still alive? Are you okay? Because nothing showed up on my Facebook page. Here, Facebook had changed the permissions to just me or only me. Nobody could see anything. And they got worried because, you know, I post a million times a day.
Right.
Yeah, so, and I couldn't change them. You know, they were there. Nobody ever saw those posts ever.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so
I mean, I can definitely see a need to keep your social life in one group separate from another, but this kind of goes back to something we talked about before about it perceived privacy and that sort of thing. Like, there's a lot of that really you perceive that these social networks that you're involved in real life are separate, but in reality, they're just walls maintained in your mind. So, I mean, these people still could interact and find out things that you may not want them to know, you know, from the other social networks or the other social circle.
Yeah.
So, you know, after you talked about Kevin Rose mentioning the MobileMe thing, you refreshed my memory about it, and I do recall them talking about MobileMe.
GoogleMe.
Or GoogleMe. Yeah. And the interesting thing about GoogleMe that I think they can really capitalize on is something that some other companies are doing. They're talking about these reputation defenders. So when you Google your name, right, you come up with all this crap about you, like possibly you, possibly somebody else with the same name as you, that sort of thing. If Google starts to basically itemize or, you know, enumerate names into some list. So when you search for a name, anything involving that name is sort of like structured underneath these, we'll just call them like, you know, identifiers, right? And then say there's 10 Ryan Lanceys out there. So it presents a list. It's like, do you mean this Ryan Lancey or this Ryan Lancey or this Ryan Lancey? And if I've logged in and enabled my profile, you know, into Google Me, I could essentially say, don't show anybody any searches about me unless I say that they're allowed to do this.
Right.
Now, they could pay for that. They could charge for this service pretty easily. Whether or not it would be ethical in terms of their search algorithms, which is another subject that has come up recently, Google tweaking their search algorithms to basically, you know, obfuscate some comp, or I'm not obfuscate, basically obliterate the competition in some other area of,
right,
that they're competing in. But anyway, I think that's a useful thing that they could do. I would think people would maybe consider paying for that, like they pay for Reputation Defender.
Yeah, and I mean, Google has all of our data anyways. You know, like if you use any product, Google Docs, Google Mail, Google has their hands in everything. So, I mean, they don't have to work that much at making this because they already have everything. You know, mm-hmm. Facebook had to work from the ground up and have us put in our information. But for most people who use the internet a lot, Google has everything.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if that's a good thing or not. You know,
I'm not sure either.
I mean, like we've said before, you know, whether or not to trust Google, I trust Google so far. I trust them with everything. My life is on Google Calendar. If I didn't have that, I would not know what I'm doing every day.
Yeah, I mean, some of the tools they provide that in that way are undeniably useful.
Right. And while we're talking about Google, we might as well talk about the browser that Google products work the best in, which is Google Chrome. And that brings us to our next article, which is more of a proof of concept, more of a scare article, but still kind of creepy nonetheless, that everybody knows that browsers can have extensions now. Firefox, Chrome, you can download little pieces of code to install into your browser to do certain things like block ads. We've talked about AdBlock before, or help you manage your websites or whatever. Little extensions you can install. Well, inside of Google Chrome, extensions aren't anything more than HTML and JavaScript. So pretty much anybody already knows how to write extensions for Google Chrome. And because Google Chrome extensions are HTML and JavaScript, they by default have access to the DOM, the document object model, which is the structure of every web page. So everything that you see inside of a web page on a web browser is a part of the DOM. And these extensions by default have access to that. So this guy's like, hey, I have access to this, so I'm just going to start stealing usernames and passwords when people enter them in. So he wrote a Chrome extension, and if you install this extension, because it has access to the DOM, he just starts sending your usernames and passwords for every site you go to back to him. So I thought that was a little creepy that it's that easy, you know, to do this.
I'm not a Java programmer by trade, but I know, you know, a little bit about how they use the password fields and stuff in web pages. And I mean, I thought they're encrypted. And once they're not?
No. No field on a web page is encrypted at all. It's all plain text. The only thing is that the web browser places an asterisk over the data so your eyes can't see it.
Right.
But the computer still knows what the letters are.
I thought password fields, though, in general, like if you copied the text back out of there, it doesn't...
For a while now, they've protected against like copy and pasting like that.
Okay, so you that's could, protected against.
Yeah, but as far as code reading the field, it's free game.
Mm, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think really what it boils down to is that Google's got to restrict their API in some way to disallow that.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, I don't even know if that's possible because of the way that they made this. I mean, it's HTML and JavaScript. It's essentially viewed by the browser the same as a web page is viewed. It might be difficult for them to restrict this, you know, because how do you do that without breaking web pages at the same time? You know, if you restrict JavaScript from accessing certain parts of the DOM, how are you going to make that separation? It might be easy. You know, they might have a way to say, this is an extension trying to access it, just block it.
Well, what would stop a JavaScript app from doing the same thing?
What do you mean by JavaScript app? Like JavaScript on a web page?
Like an applet, yeah. Like if I have JavaScript on a page, I mean, why can't it access the DOM and do the same thing?
It can, and that's how a lot of things do, like cross-site
so
scripting attacks.
So every browser would have this vulnerability, just not in their plugin section.
Right, yeah. Technically, this is a problem if anybody can inject JavaScript into your page, any malicious web page. You know, you've heard of cross-site scripting attacks and things like that where people were able to inject malicious code. So, yeah, that's a problem everywhere.
But even beyond injecting malicious code, what if I just set up a web server out there and I get people to click on my web server somehow through some ad, and the ad itself takes you to a web page that I set up and put in malicious JavaScript?
Entirely possible.
Right. So, I mean, to me, this doesn't sound all that alarming then.
Yeah, I think the point of the article was just that now it can be hidden in an extension, you know, just kind of like we talked about last week with the books that got in the Apple App Store, that you look at it and you think, oh, this is pretty cool. You know, this is legit. And you download it and all of a sudden people have your password. So it's just another way to hide it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if you make your own web page, you know, Google's probably going to log that pretty soon as a malicious site. And, you know, Firefox is going to start blocking it as a phishing site or something. But yeah, this is just that it's now infiltrated extensions. So, you know, just another watch out, you know, if you're downloading stuff, like always, you know, buyer beware. Don't get stuff from non-legit sources. So moving along to some Microsoft talk, Windows 8 is not out yet, been worked on for a while in Microsoft, and a lot of people are now thinking that this is going to be another Windows 2000. They think, you know, Windows Vista's come out, that's a client-style OS, you know, a personal OS. Windows 7 came out, that's a personal OS. And now that Microsoft is looking so heavily into virtualization with their Hyper-V product, and everything that they're doing, everything that they're pushing and advertising now is business-based, people are really starting to think that Windows 8 is going to be the next step of Windows 2000. It's going to be an OS that comes out that only businesses use, that you don't want to get if you're a home user. Have you heard anything about Windows 8 or anything that they're doing about that?
Actually, this is one of the first things I've read about it, so I'm not very familiar.
Yeah, so the article is on PC Magazine's website, PCMag.com. And they basically just go through how all of the features that are coming out to Windows 8 only have benefits in the corporation. You know, they're all business user benefits. They're all IT administrator benefits. All kinds of stuff about the trusted platform module and how administrators can easily or more easily administer their system and the software on it, virtualize things. They're adding a lot of cloud computing components. So unlike, you know, Vista and Windows 7, where they really focused on the user interface and making it prettier and easier to use, everything so far for Windows 8 has been business oriented.
Well, I mean, listening, the other features that I'm seeing there listed are definitely, you know, business-centric, but especially like virtualization. But the cloud computing part of it, I mean, I think that's something that's going to penetrate both business and consumer-level computing eventually and allow, if there's better integration between cloud computing or cloud storage providers and the OS, I think that's a better thing for consumers too.
Oh, definitely. One thing that I don't want to see happen is, do you remember the whole Sidekick debacle?
Yeah.
The phone, it's a phone, the Sidekick, it stored everything in the cloud, contacts, you know, all your data that you put on it. And one day, the cloud just became unavailable and everybody's phone stopped working.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's just one thing that we need to, we're programming it. That's one thing that Microsoft needs to look into, that they don't make that same mistake again, you know.
Oh, I think they learned a pretty good lesson on that one.
Right.
You know, that said, I mean, there's so much you can, there's risk mitigation on every type of server, but That could happen to anyone.
Right.
I mean, if you can put in backup after backup, and I think eventually they were able to retrieve the data.
Yeah, after a while they got it back. Nobody really lost anything per se, but for that time that it was down, you know, their phones were worthless. They didn't have contacts. They didn't have their data.
Yeah.
It was just like a landline phone. You can pick up and dial numbers. That's all it did. But that just makes the push towards, you know, you do need local storage. Hopefully nobody who's doing cloud-based services thinks that you can do everything only in the cloud. You know, local storage definitely has its benefits. And keeping on Microsoft, this was something interesting. It's a very short article, basically just mentioning a quote from a recent Microsoft Worldwide Partner Conference that Steve Ballmer said Microsoft is hardcore, that's a quote, about tablet computing. So this, we've all heard about the Microsoft Courier, and that was going to be like the tablet to crush all tablets. I mean, have you seen videos or... Not videos, but the concept videos of the Courier.
Yeah, it was like a dual-sided tablet, more of like a...
Like an open book.
A book, yeah, that had one side with sort of a display. The other side had maybe some kind of like buttons or writing interface.
Well, they both had displays, but one of them allowed like writing input and everything. Yeah. Yeah, and that... I mean, the way it looked, the way the concept looked, that was going to be amazing.
Yeah.
But it's... I mean, it's no longer. That was really just a concept. Everybody thought it was coming out, but it's not.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about Microsoft is 90% of the time with the hardware, it's prototype hardware to develop some concept for third-party manufacturers. So, I mean, we may not see something from Microsoft like that, but, you know, it's sort of trying to get the ball rolling conceptually.
Right, we may see something real soon, a tablet running Windows 7 mobile version operating system, you know, something like that. But yeah, apparently, I mean, look for it soon. You know, this is Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft, saying they haven't dropped out of the tablet market. And if whatever they do come out with or whatever other manufacturer comes out with is anything like the Courier, it's going to be awesome. Because I would have bought the Courier if it came out. Even though I hate Microsoft, that was the tablet to end all tablets.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. I hope it comes about. I hope they don't mess it up. And I hope it doesn't drop away like the Crunch Pad did, too. That was going to be another tablet to end all tablets that no longer. And we were talking about Windows 8 and the new operating systems from Microsoft, but let's talk a little bit about the old operating system, that being Windows XP. It will not die, no matter what Microsoft tries to do. I mean, they came out with Vista, XP's still around. They came out with 7, XP's still around. Now Microsoft announces, even though Windows 7 is out, that you can use Windows XP, and you can even downgrade Windows 7 to Windows XP until the year 2020. So 10 more years of you being able to get a brand new, fresh copy of Windows XP on your brand new computer. So if this doesn't tell you, I mean, I don't know what this says. If to me, just look, glancing over this article, this tells me that people don't like Vista or 7, that people are still asking for the older OS. But on the other hand, you know, we both work in the business world on these machines, and we know that a lot of the push is probably coming from businesses and their applications, you know, only using XP and breaking on newer versions.
Yeah, what surprises me is that, you know, especially in the business environment, that virtualization hasn't taken a stronger role, like in replacing the need to have a computer with Windows XP on it. I mean, I have a machine with a XP VM on it. It works really well. There's a few snags, but for the most part, it works really well.
Yeah, I mean, virtualization, I mean, it's been around for a long time. Everybody thinks it's going to kill real hardware every year. You know, somebody predicts that, and it just doesn't. I don't know why.
Well, it's catching up. I mean, if you think about it, like 5 years ago, it wasn't even... barely possible to get it done on a normal desktop.
Possible, but not feasible.
Right. I mean, there's VM servers and dedicated hardware, and I mean, VMware's been around a while, but 10 years ago, it was like, you know, a gleam in someone's eye. You know, so I think we've come a long way where you can download Microsoft Virtual PC and, you know, take an ISO of XP install, and it pretty much just works. And the XP mode stuff in Windows 7 works really well, too. Which is kind of a behind-the-scenes virtualization.
Right, it's actually the whole operating system there.
Yeah.
That they're virtualizing through Windows 7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, my guess is, I don't know that there's another Service Pack coming out, but I don't think they're going to extend Service Pack 3 beyond 2014, which is what they said would be the last...
Right, the original date.
Yeah, the original date. So, they typically... A new service pack comes out and there's some life to it. You know, they give some like service life to it. So that to me signals that there might be a Service Pack 4 for Windows XP.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of Service Pack 3, for those of you still running Windows XP, if you're not running Service Pack 3, you need to go download it right now because there is no more support for Service Pack 2. So if you've wondered why your little Windows Update icon in the corner hasn't prompted you for any updates recently, it's because there aren't any more for Service Pack 2. So if you like not getting hacked, upgrade, you know, go download Service Pack 3. You know, if you're on a slow connection, I know it's going to take an hour to download, but put up with it.
Worth your time.
Yeah, worth your time to keep getting the Windows updates. That is something you should not ever not do. There's a lot of nots.
Well, I mean, how about looking at it from this direction? What do you think it says about Windows XP in terms of operating systems to have the longevity that this operating system has had?
I think it shows that Windows XP is definitely right up on top of the mountain as one of the best operating systems ever.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things about XP that I don't like, and I'm sure there's a lot of things that a lot of people have things that I'm not even aware of they don't like, but, you know, that I think that's impressive. It's the OS came out in October of 2001, and it's going on 10 years here. This thing's been around.
Right, and you can still use it for new things.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like whenever, you know, a new operating system came out and made Windows 98 old, you couldn't do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
You can still go buy the newest version of Crysis and make an XP machine your gaming PC that does everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, so XP is definitely up on the top of the hill as one of the best consumer OSs ever. And I'm interested to see what Microsoft's going to do when 2020 comes, or even when 2014 comes and SP3, quote-unquote, dies, mm-hmm. if a new service pack comes out. I don't know that they're going to add any new features.
Probably not. I mean, these are just downgrade rights, too. It's just saying, oh, you can downgrade it if you want to, but they may or may not support you, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I would like to think that they would still support you. Like, why would they give you... Somebody could sue them for that. You gave me the option to downgrade XP, and now you're not going to support me?
Well, they don't have to. I don't think there's any legal obligation if it's not in the terms of service or the EULA.
Yeah, and they change those all the time. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, 2014, 2020, they are right around the corner. So, last article before we take a break came from the Washington Policy blog, and it's another net neutrality article, and this one... It kind of made me laugh, and here's why. The title of the article, FCC reclassification could cost billions in investment and thousands of jobs. Now, did you read through this article?
No, I didn't get a chance to look at this one.
Okay, so what I got out of this article is kind of the extreme case. You know, whenever we talk about net neutrality and the things that the FCC is trying to do with, you know, stopping companies like Comcast... You know, it's a very simple thing. It's you know, classifying the internet in such a way that big companies can't abuse their bigness. But this article kind of takes it to an extreme, and they're like, well, if you do that, then companies can do this. And if they do that, then they can do this. And then these people can do this. And then this person can do this. And then we have billions of people out of a job, and we're losing $20 kajillion. So that's what I got out of this article, that it was an extreme case of, well, this is a slippery slope, and if the FCC slides the whole way down the slope... This is what could happen, which is true. You know, if the FCC becomes the bad guys and starts doing, you know, all of the things that people are afraid that they can do once they get this power, then yeah, this is a problem that, you know, reclassifying the internet, all these companies with their investment, you know, it's going to kill some jobs. But I just don't see it.
Well, I think there's a really good use case or example case for this in the past, and that's the Telecommunications Act and what happened with AT&T and the regulation that went on. You know, they still have this universal service fund. If you ever wonder what this little, you know, fee you're paying on your phone bills for, it's to basically make a fund so that they can invest in rural access to telephone services, which was a big deal, you know, a long time ago when they were trying to roll out telephone service to, you know, the entire United States. And there's actually some thought that they could maybe revamp this universal service fund to provide rural access to the...
For broadband, rural access to
broadband. Actually, Walt Mossberg commented in his opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal, an article he wrote, that he thinks that the national broadband plan that we have right now invests way too much time and money into rural access rather than bringing our standards up to other competitive countries. I'm not so sure that our broadband is really all that bad. I mean, I think access to it, one, is important, and good speed's another. But getting back to the topic of this, we probably could study what happened with the regulation of the phone industry and see, did that really cost jobs or cost us the promise of new jobs? And there's, you know, there's two ways of looking
at that.
That's
a big big difference there.
A big difference, yeah. And
you're not losing jobs if you just don't happen to get new ones.
Right. And I mean, the telephone industry, if you include the cell phone industry especially, I think has been a huge area for growth in the last 60 years to, you know, probably even longer. You know, it's always been a big growth area. I think the telecommunication industry probably makes quite a bit of money. And let's not forget the fact that in the presence of all that regulation on the telephone companies, the internet still was invented and runs on those same circuits.
Right.
So I think this may be a little bit alarmist.
That's definitely how I see it. Yeah, it's one of those worst case scenario, you know, right or left wing nut job articles. Okay, so before we move on, word from our sponsor. This portion of the Slongcast is brought to you by Sex Panther Cologne for Men. Only the sexiest men smell of desire. Only the sexiest men smell like a used diaper filled with Indian food. Only the sexiest men smell like a turd covered in burnt hair. Sex Panther. Made with real bits of panther, so you know it's good. Sex Panther. 60% of the time, it works every time. So that was Sex Panther cologne. Any of you guys use this? Ryan, do you use Sex Panther?
I've heard about it once or twice, but...
Yeah, I don't use it myself. It's very expensive. I have a hard time finding it in stores.
With small bits of panther, anything will be expensive.
Oh, I know. There's got to be something illegal about that. So anyway, moving on. The next bunch of articles are all about mobile phones. Mobile phones seem to be taking over the topics every week. There is just so much to talk about, so much innovation, so much good stuff, so much bad stuff. This first article here is just something kind of cool. You know, it really doesn't fit in with the themes of anything we've ever talked about before. But it's a new phone, the Modu phone, M-O-D-U. And if anybody's ever watched Zoolander, and you remember the phone that Derek Zoolander had that was like the size of his pinky, and he had to pull it out and, you know, unflip it, this is almost there. This phone is about the size of your thumb. The world's lightest cell phone. It's coming to the United Kingdom. And it's also in Israel. Have you seen this before, the Modu phone?
I did see the article on Engadget a couple days ago. It's really... I mean, miniaturization is impressive to some extent. But when human usability, if it takes a back seat to the size, then I think it's, you know...
Oh, yeah. I don't know what you can do with this, because if you go to Engadget and search for Modu and look at the picture, there are no buttons. Not buttons, sorry. There are no numbers on the phone. How do you dial a number?
Well, there's no numbers on the iPhone.
But there are virtual numbers.
Well, there could be virtual numbers.
Really? The screen is like the size of your thumbnail.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the miniaturization is awesome, that they can fit a cell phone in something, you know, 1 inch by 2 inches. But I just thought it was cool. I had to bring it up and point it out to everybody. Go take a look, and maybe it'll come to the United States. Maybe this is...
Keep an eye out for the upcoming touchscreen-based Modu 2.
Ooh, the Modu 2. The iPhone killer. Okay, so a sad day. A day that I have been predicting for a long time. And maybe not predicting, but worried about. A day that I have really been worried about. And why I tell people... Don't ever jailbreak or root your phones. So this is not a news article. This comes from a forum post on Android forums. So this guy, he was driving down the road. I should say beforehand, he rooted his phone, you know, started putting, you know, unauthorized applications on it. So he was driving down the road and the people in front of him crashed. What was the first thing he wanted to do? Dial 911. Get the ambulance, get the police there. Could he? No. His phone did not work. You know, he mentions it, you know, it did work before he rooted it, but since he's rooted it, it started he doesn't say what all problems it has caused him, but he says it started causing him problems, and now he can't call 911, Luckily, nobody died because other people saw the accident, stopped, and called 911. But, you know, this is what I warn people about whenever they think, oh, I can jailbreak, you know, root my phone and put all these cool applications on that you can't get in the App Store. I keep telling people, and I'm still going to tell you, don't do it. You know, if this happened to you and there was nobody else around, you would be dead. You know, have you ever heard of this happening before? This is the first time I've heard of it.
Yeah. The interesting thing is, you know, I know some people that have had Droid phones, and they've experienced just random, you know, phone reboots sometimes when they dial a number. You know, it happens. I mean, the phones are definitely...
That's just funny that you say, oh, it happens. Well, like, that's a normal thing on a phone.
It isn't. I mean, we've come to sort of... The functionality is taken, you know, is not as important as some, or the base functionality, like the purpose.
The phone functionality.
Yeah. We're willing to accept a lower standard of a phone. And, you know, this has been the case for a while with smartphones because, and even just mobile phones in general, because there is not a mobile phone made that sounds better or is more comfortable to use than your classic, like, Bell Labs landline phone, the one that weighs like 10 pounds and has a real bell in it. Like, those, if you want to sit and like talk on the phone, they're very comfortable, like, to use, and they're you can hear things real well. And
yeah, so. Let me just interject something there real quick. I mean, this is a point that Jason Calacanis, if any of you ever or know Jason Calacanis, he's a big venture capitalist. You know, him and Mike Arrington did TechCrunch 50, which is a big conference where they let people come in, startups pitch their business, and then they, you know, award them millions of dollars to get their business off the ground. So this guy, you know, tries to help out a lot of people. But in one of his commentaries, he was talking about, you know, if you want to get money from people, if you're trying to talk to a venture capitalist or an angel investor, do not use your cell phone. If you want $2 million, call me on a landline. Because if I hear static or if the call drops, it is over. And I mean, that's, like you said, you know, we've just accepted it and everybody uses it for business. But, you know, just a pointer to those people making big deals, do not do it over a mobile phone, especially when you're driving. You don't know when you're going to go through a dead zone. But yeah, the point of this article just, you know, kind of scares me. And I'll still tell people, don't jailbreak, don't root your phone, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, it's there for a reason. You're ultimately having this phone because at some point in your life, you will need the ability to contact somebody.
You know, the government, it has not been outside the bounds of the state or federal government to set requirements on 911 services. They did this with the phones provided by the cable companies. When the cable companies started offering phone service, one of the problems with cable-based phones is they require power from the wall. And they enforced that those phones contain a battery backup so that in the case of a power failure, you're still able to make phone calls.
Yeah, that was a big deal. A lot of people never upgraded to VoIP phones because of the whole 911 trouble.
Right. You really need to have them on a UPS and along with your router, if there's another router, to maintain your phone signal in the event of a power failure. So maybe we need to look into some kind of regulation that says if you're going to provide 911 services on your phone and that the customer is has the understanding that this feature is part of the phone, I'm paying money for it.
They should be able to call 911.
Right. So we might need some kind of lower level thing where when you dial 911, the phone drops into some lower level OS, you know, that's very purpose built, that has been maybe not accredited, but you know, verified by some
kind of jailed from the other application, so
right.
Nothing can affect it.
Exactly, like critical application that always is available. It'd probably be in the best interest of all the phone manufacturers to design their actual phone application so that it works all the time.
Right.
Because nothing bothers me more when I've even used like Motorola Razors. That you make a phone call and all of a sudden the phone just reboots. Maybe it's been dropped, but, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's frustrating.
Yeah, it's not a smartphone-only problem. I mean, it's a problem on every phone, but, yeah, I mean, and they've already made regulation. You know, that's why, you know, we need digital cell phones now because, you know, the 911 access, the GPS, mm-hmm. You know, that's why you can't use your cell phones from 10 years ago anymore because they don't meet that regulation. So, you know, this is just another step in the right direction that somebody needs to take.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to be driving down the road wreck or see a wreck and not be able to call 911. That is not cool. So getting off of the sad stuff, still keeping with Android, though. The new phone, the Droid X, that is on Verizon, it comes with a new type of technology that I'm sure the people at Motorola thought was amazing. It's called eFuse. Basically, you know, E-fuse, you know, like a normal fuse you would use in any electrical circuit. And it works pretty much the exact same way, that whenever it blows, stuff stops working. And the point of eFuse is that if you try to jailbreak your phone or root your phone, you know, whatever you want to call it for whatever OS you are, and install some sort of third-party, unvalidated, unverified OS onto the ROM, basically to replace the default Android OS or whatever that the manufacturer put on, this eFuse is going to blow and technically brick your phone. So the whole hoopla about this was that everybody thought at the beginning that it was like brick your phone. Like there's nothing you can do. You have to send it back to Motorola. It turns out it's not that bad, but it is still a bricking. Your phone will not work until you find some way to put back on a verified, validated Android OS onto the phone. And I've done some reading about this. I still don't know if you can do that yourself or if you have to get help from Motorola to do this. The phone doesn't brick. It goes into recovery mode until you can put on a real version of the OS that came from the manufacturer. I don't know if you can do that yourself. Do you know?
Well, I don't know for sure, but usually these phones come with a CD or some kind of software download that like allows you to restore the phone to factory default. So, but yeah, there was a lot of hype initially that this was like actually an like they call it eFuse,
right? Yeah,
and that it actually like blew some circuits in the phone that were unrepairable. Like you know, it I don't know how it would do it exactly, but some sort of like fusible link that's on the PCB, but that's not the case. So I don't know. I kind of see this as a way for Motorola to protect their, you know, these companies deal with a lot of different users. So I think if you're going to design a ROM and you want to root your phone or hack it or whatever else, if you're not smart enough to load it so that it doesn't do these things, then you probably shouldn't be doing it at all.
Right. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, people like us, you know, we want the functionality on our phone that we can make it do whatever we want, mm-hmm. you know, but for the other 99% of the population, they need something that is going to work and they need to be, you know, this is just a way to pretty much protect people mm-hmm. that they don't install some rogue OS, you know, from some crappy link that they found on the internet. So, yeah, I mean, it's good and it's bad. I don't like the way this was originally marketed. You know, this is kind of like the problem with the iPhone. The marketing or the advertising or whatever you want to call it got out of hand real quickly. Mm-hmm. And people just freaked out about it. But it turns out it's not so bad. So it's not enough to make me tell people don't buy a Droid X because of this. But like I said before, you shouldn't be rooting your phones anyways. What's
yeah.
wrong with you?
Exactly.
Okay, so I think this was one of the articles that you wanted to talk about. The Windows 7... or Windows Phone 7 coming to HTC phones?
Actually, I don't think I submitted this one, but I actually just saw the review or the preview on Engadget about the Windows Phone 7.
So you know more than me automatically. I didn't see that.
Yeah. There's a couple interesting things. I've talked about the UI before on the Songcast. It's really, I think, inventive. It's very forward-looking. It doesn't use a classic icon-based interface.
Yeah, this was a tile-based interface, right?
It's tile-based, and it uses these scrollable sort of views on the phone, and it's they have another word for it. I can't think of it right now. It's sort of you can scroll through layers as well. So you scroll left to right and through layers on the app. There's just a flurry of articles that came out today, though, there was a NDA on the information, non-disclosure agreement, with most of the big, bloggers and review sites. And that was released today, so a bunch of articles came out. And there's a lot of, there's some Samsung test hardware that was displayed with Windows Phone 7 running on it. And it's It's very slick looking. From the videos that I saw, the scrolling is on par, and the pinch and zoom is on par, the touch sensitivity, all that with the iPhone and the best Android phones out there. They've really spent a lot of time looking at the user interface from what I've seen. Two interesting things that I thought were very surprising. One is that copy and paste is not foreseen to be a feature of the OS outside of the Office applications that it has.
Yeah, that is something I did see that really threw me back.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed about that, though. They may have other ways of getting around that. You know, maybe you'll be able to use the content in a different way. Like, you know, instead of copying, I'm trying to think of the use cases on my BlackBerry that I use copy and paste. One is when I buy an app and it needs a registration code. So an email might come with a registration code. I need to copy the code and paste it into the app, right? Well, maybe their app store won't have registration codes. Maybe it'll have some other method of authorization. Like, that's an example that they may just circumvent that use case. You don't need that anymore. Interestingly enough, it's not there. It was a big thing, a big point of contention about the iPhone.
Yeah, people pretty much made fun of Apple a lot for not having copy and paste.
Yeah, you know, maybe Microsoft has done their homework on the and studied it and said it really doesn't need to be there. I mean, in the case of the iPhone early on, if you wanted to get an MMS message, you had they used to email you a link to it with this code. So you'd have to go to the link and then type the code in to get the MMS message.
And without multitasking, you had to close down programs 12 times to memorize the code.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. Like that. So if Microsoft out of the gate has MMS support, which they will, and they will allow multitasking in the built-in apps, just like Apple always has, so that, you know, that there's that. But the other interesting feature is that they will not allow third-party multitasking at this point.
Really?
Yeah. There was an interview that what's the guy from Engadget? Tom Kosky.
Josh Topolsky?
Topolsky, yes. Yeah. He did an interview with the VP of the Windows Phone, project at the Microsoft, and he said it's not going to be available, at least in the initial release. They're working with the partners closely to develop that and solicit feedback on how to best implement it. They said they're focusing on battery life and you know, other content that I think they'll probably provide through their built-in apps.
Yeah, that's weird that they didn't at least add in kind of what Apple does for applications that don't take advantage of the multitasking APIs, which is it freezes it in place.
Oh, it does that. It has,
so you won't lose your place in
it. No,
an app.
It does have sleep. They do have app sleep. That's definitely there. But one thing that will probably not be available, at least from the sounds of it, is a Twitter application that is able to, in the background, get the tweets from the people you follow.
Update you as they come in.
Right. Right now, they have built-in Facebook integration, but they haven't included Twitter as one of the listed ones. So,
yeah, that's surprising.
It is. But that said, this is a huge paradigm shift in how we interface or will interface with these phones. With the whole new tile interface, and some of the software is just beautiful looking. I mean, it works seamlessly with the Samsung hardware they've provided from the videos I've seen. I'm really impressed with it. I'm really excited to see what they do with it. And they said they have thousands of developers that they know are developing applications. And they've had hundreds of thousands of downloads of the SDK, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, and this whole thing about, you know, the features. I mean, this isn't unique to Microsoft. This isn't unique to Apple. This is just something that happens when you release a product, that there are certain cool features that just get left on the cutting room floor because other things are more important.
Yeah.
You know, so they have to make decisions to cut their losses somewhere. And like you said, probably come out in the next release.
Yep.
So not going to be that big of a deal. But there is something about a remote kill for the phones that it just came out?
Well, this is another example of, I think, biased media sometimes. There's a lot of hatred, I think, out there against the Windows Mobile environment. And I owned a Windows Mobile phone. I did move away from it. I think most of the problems I had with it were the slowness of the hardware. And you could blame that on the OS. Maybe it's too bloated. But I'd seen it work okay on other phones. It's just that there were certain things about that phone I liked, but the slowness was definitely not one of them. Anyway, one of the features that was called out recently that they've added to Windows 7 is remote wipe and kill. And the truth is that Windows Mobile, now Windows Phone is technically a new product, but it's still, they're calling it version 7, and the last version out there was 6.5.
It's the same lineage.
Same lineage. It's a different, it's very different in terms of the application development, and it uses a new CE core and all this other stuff, or CE kernel. But Windows Mobile has had remote wipe and kill using the mobile device manager in Windows since 2008. So it's not a new feature to Windows Mobile. I think it just shows a lack in the, some an example. There's just an example of the lack of diligence done on the part of some of these tech reporters.
Yeah, and this article came from Information Week.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a heavy hitter.
Yeah, it shows by this is another a really good example of this, and I've mentioned this before, is when Jason Calacanis tweeted all the specs on the iPad, and he fooled the Washington Post, the New York Times.
He fooled everybody.
Everybody were printing what he said verbatim on their websites of national newspapers and well-known bloggers.
As gospel truth.
Yeah, as gospel truth. Without even calling him to ask him if it's the truth, regardless of whether or not. Now, somebody could say, well, he shouldn't have done that, but they should not have printed it.
Yeah, seriously.
As you know, and this is another example. I think that if the tech journalists want to have, if they want to be seen with quality journalism in this new media world, that they've got to do their homework. So, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there was some belief that Windows 7 wouldn't have remote wipe and kill, and then they said, oh, yeah, it will. But that's not the way the article was presented.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a possibility, but I don't believe that for one second, just because, you know, Windows Mobile is, I don't want to say heavy in the business arena, but it's kind of right behind BlackBerry. You know, Apple products are not in the enterprise, the business arena. So really the only competitors for the longest time were BlackBerry and Windows Mobile. Those were your two choices. And knowing that fact, every business who has these devices requires a remote wipe and kill ability. So yeah, I mean, it had to have been there. And it, like you said, it was.
Yeah. The wording that was used too was just, you know, it was obvious that it was they're trying to play catch up in this arena. And the truth is, you know, I said it before, Microsoft invented this market.
Moving on from Microsoft to another OS is the new version of the BlackBerry OS from RIM. So what's all the big hype about that?
Well, from what I've seen, I think RIM is starting to play catch up a little bit in some of the areas that they've been lacking. And I think, the version 6 is definitely a start at that. I don't know. Have you seen much about it, Kevin?
I haven't seen much about it, but I have seen mentions of things like a pinch to zoom, which is, you know, something that's been standard on the iPhone since it came out. It's something that Android has recently added. It's something that all phones have now recently added. And it's something that makes me mad when I'm playing with my friend's BlackBerry. A couple of my friends have the BlackBerry Storm, mm-hmm. and they give it to me, and, you know, I play around with it, and I'm just on a web page and trying to zoom, and I can't do it. How do you zoom? I can't figure it out.
Yeah, it's challenging even on the non-touchscreen hardware. When you have I have a BlackBerry Tour, and you want to zoom in on a picture, it's not that easy. But one of the really cool things is they're going to have a browser based on WebKit. I think
that is awesome.
Yeah, I think that's a big move in the right direction for BlackBerry. Their browser has definitely been a sore spot.
Yeah, what was the name of their browser? Like, didn't they have their own developed browser? They didn't use an engine that anybody else used?
I don't know the name of the back end other than just it was called BlackBerry Browser.
Yeah, the Palm OS, for, like the Palm Trios, they had, I think it was called Blazor, was their own browser that was absolutely horrible. But it is nice to see that, you know, BlackBerry's now catching up with everybody else and using a real web browser engine on their mobile platform.
Yeah, they're also providing a new social networking feature on the phone that's going to aggregate updates from social networks into some, like, I guess, built-in API for that.
And doesn't it do some sort of mapping to, like, your contact list? So everybody, you know, your phone book basically becomes your social network in a way.
Well, they've had that ability. At least the Facebook app provided that to link the contacts and that sort of thing. I've never been a big fan of it because I manage my contacts in Google, and I use Google Sync to do that. But
yeah, so hopefully, you know, we mentioned before that if RIM doesn't come out with something new and awesome very soon, it's going to be bad for them. And it looks like with BlackBerry 6, they at least have a lot of new features that they are playing catch up, but it looks like they might have caught up if they release all of these.
I guess that's what I mentioned before. I think they've really focused on security and the core OS part of it for a long time.
Yeah, they've been the enterprise leader.
Yeah, and now if they can integrate these new consumer features and present a really nice forward-facing app UI, that they may really have a contender.
Right, and that'll be awesome if, you know, we have Android, we have Apple, we have Windows Mobile, we have BlackBerry, you know, we have four strong competitors in the mobile arena. I think it'll really push innovation because people will now have to one up each other instead of Apple being the king of the mountain and everybody playing catch up. So speaking of Apple, our last bunch of articles are all about Apple. You're probably expecting me to start talking about the iPhone, but I have one article that is not iPhone, well, technically not iPhone related, before we get into that, and that is about iAd. Now, we talked about iAd before whenever WWDC rolled around and that this was Apple's new way of putting ads inside of their iPhone applications, and it was going to be much better than the way they'd done it before. And some people have actually started implementing them. And this is basically just a first thoughts on what those developers think about iAd compared to the other ways that they've had the ability to put ads into applications. And so far, everything looks good. The numbers, this one guy, let me just read a small quote from the article. One developer reported Thursday on Hacker News that he had earned $1,400 in one day via iAd for a simple application that turns the flash on the iPhone 4's camera into a flashlight. So that doesn't happen. You know, later on in the article, this article comes from the Wall Street Journal, so we would like to assume that it's legitimate. Later on, they say that, you know, normally if you have a really high-grossing ad in a mobile application, you're lucky to get $148 a day. This dude took in $1,400 in a single day. So to me, looks good. Obviously, you know, this is just a, hey, it's cool, let's click on the ads. You know, nobody's really seen an iAd before, so it's new to everybody. Of course, everybody's going to be clicking on them, seeing what they're all about. But it seems the general gist of the article is that iAd is that good. You know, the dude's not going to be able to keep up $1,400 a day, but he is going to be able to keep up more than the standard $148 a day because iAd is just that good of a platform.
What I'd be interested to know is whether or not that's $148 like per application or total, like how many applications this guy have fielded. Because $148 a day per application wouldn't be too bad.
That would be awesome.
Because I mean, if you're talking about a developer that's trying to make a living at this, which, you know, maybe has other income sources, but, you know, I think any work you do should, you know, you should be able to make a living at it if you dedicated yourself to it and to make it really worthwhile, because otherwise it's really just a hobby. So, you know, say you have four or five applications out there, you know, this might be pretty decent, you know.
Yeah, so that $148 a day, if you make that every day of the year, that is a $54,000 a year salary.
Right, which sounds decent, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of people would enjoy a salary like that. But as a freelance programmer, it's actually not that great because you got to pay for benefits and everything else.
Right. Yeah, and like you said, you know, he might have two or three applications, so he might be pulling in $150,000 a year,
right,
on the old style. So now with iAd, you know, this guy, we could start seeing some self-made millionaires real quick just writing mobile phone applications.
Yeah. I'm really excited, just not to get, you know, too far off topic, but I'm excited for Windows Phone 7 because it uses Visual Studio as the development environment, and there's a lot of developers that know how to use Visual Studio.
Yeah, we mentioned this before. They already have the base.
Yeah, so, and the SDK is out there, so if you're into developing phone apps and you haven't tried it, you can get the SDK for free.
Yeah, unlike with Apple, where I believe you have to pay $100 to join the developer network to get the SDK.
Yeah, that sucks.
It does. It really does. I was going to do it, but I'm not paying $100. And plus, I can't figure out Xcode, so I'm screwed anyways. But now we move into some talk about the iPhone and the problems the iPhone's having. The first one is not necessarily about the iPhone, but about Apple and AT&T in general. And that is, we had talked about the possibility of a class action suit coming against Apple for all of these antenna problems. And a federal judge has granted class action status to a monopoly lawsuit against Apple and AT&T. So this isn't really all about the antenna problem, but this is, you know, like a lot of people have been talking for a while that Apple being limited to AT&T, they're thinking that's a monopoly. And apparently a federal court also thinks that is true. So what do you think, Ryan? Now, just about the monopoly, you know, in general.
Well, you know, the libertarian in me says there should be nothing wrong with two companies, you know, making a business agreement and, you know, and using it. And I think we're specifically talking about just the fact that the iPhone's only available on...
Yeah, this article doesn't technically mention the antenna problems at all.
Right. So we're just talking about the fact that it's only available on AT&T. So, you know, like I said, that aspect of me says this should be allowed. But on the other hand, it does unfairly position, you know, Apple, or I'm sorry, AT&T, such that, you know, if they have something people want and only they have it, and it's really not their technology, you're not providing what customers want. That's the thing that I see, at least for Apple, where they're missing the mark. Customers want an iPhone on Verizon because they like Verizon's network.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny that you look at the iPhone in any other country, and it is on every network. Recently on Twit, they had on Will Harris. He lives in the UK. And Leo asked him, you know, what carrier is the iPhone on in the UK? And Will's like, all of them?
Yeah.
Like, literally all of them.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the deal is here in the United States. You know, literally every other country has at least more than one, if not all, carriers carrying the iPhone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of these problems are probably going to disappear when LTE is fielded. Whenever an LTE iPhone comes out, hopefully, you know, this won't be a problem, at least in terms of making hardware that works on both networks. That said, I've read reports, recent reports, that Apple has Verizon towers on its campus.
Steve Jobs mentioned that during the press conference on Friday.
Yeah, I thought that's where I saw it. So that's, you know, that's interesting. But they could be LTE towers. Maybe they're planning an LTE release, you know, with the next generation iPhone, because they'll be the first to market with an LTE network.
And that's something I tweeted about a couple weeks ago. You know, everybody's saying the iPhone's going to come to Verizon. I say no.
Yeah.
I say the iPhone will not come to Verizon until Verizon goes LTE, because of the simple fact that you can't do internet and voice at the same time.
Right.
And
well,
I think Steve is one of those people that, you know, if you can't do a feature like that, you're not getting the phone.
That's true, but some of that's a little bit of a misnomer. From what I've read, Verizon's network, EVDO, does support data and voice at the same time, but it's something that they don't have enabled right now. Whether that's a hardware thing or a software thing, I'm not sure.
Yeah, where in the chain, whether it's phone, tower, server.
Yeah, I think it might be a tower-based thing, and possibly a bandwidth management. But, you know, AT&T has so many problems with their network. You know,
Didn't see this, but I just rolled my eyes.
Yeah, if you look at it from that aspect, like, oh, they have this feature, but the network barely works. It's like, well, what's – I think sometimes the features have to take a back seat to function. You know, you have to, it has to function all the time correctly. You know, then you can start adding these awesome features on.
Right, yeah. This is kind of the new way of picking out what phone you get. You know, it used to be, oh, I want this phone. But now, really, you have to say, what network works?
Yeah.
And then pick a phone that is on that network.
Yeah, at least in your area.
Yeah, in your area, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, I don't care. I like the iPhone. I'm going to pick it no matter what. But
yeah, that's because you're a fanboy.
Yeah. Anyways, so the last couple stories are hopefully, well, I don't want to say hopefully, but probably what most of you tuned in to hear is all of the problems, and I promised hard facts about the iPhone 4's antenna. And I'm going to give a quick summary, and basically this is what I predicted. It is not a big deal. So here is what I see really happened, and it is basically just because of the nature of the internet. Somebody bought an iPhone 4, they live in a low-signal area, and they said, holy crap, I'm holding my phone, there are no bars, let me videotape this and put it on the internet. And, you know, with a new device like that, they did what anybody would have done. They, you know, emailed Engadget and Gizmodo and said, dude, check out this video, you need to write an article right now. And then Gizmodo picked it up and did it. And then, of course, once you get on a site like that, gajillions of people are going to see it. But, yeah, it turns out, at least from the numbers, Steve Jobs had a press conference on Friday to talk about all this, to say how they were going to fix it, what they were going to do, to explain the problem. And I watched the press conference. I wrote down the numbers from the conference just so you can get an idea of how big of a problem this actually was. So, of all the gajillion people who ordered, I really don't know the number. It's like 4 million or something. It's a huge number of people who have an iPhone 4. 0.55% actually called Apple support, AppleCare support, to complain about it. Less than 1% of people with an iPhone 4 called and complained. 1.7% actually returned the phone. Now, keep in mind that the 3GS, 6% of people returned the 3GS when they first got it because it didn't work for them. Mm-hmm. So the iPhone 4 is already, you know, less than a third of that. And Steve asked for some numbers from AT&T saying, people were saying the iPhone 4 is dropping calls. Tell us, you know, how many. And AT&T is like, uh-uh. You know, we're not giving away that number because people are going to know how bad we suck. But they did tell Steve the amount the delta between the 3GS and the 4, what the difference is. And the iPhone 4 does drop more calls than the 3GS, but it's less than 1%. It's less than 1 for every 100 calls.
Less than 1% more than the 3G.
More than the 3GS.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so it does drop more than the 3GS, but it's less than 1% more than the 3GS. So, you know, of all those numbers, you know, less than a percent calling support, a little more than a percent returning them, this was clearly something that just exploded because of the power of the internet.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I've had mine since day -1. You know, if you saw my Twitter account, I got it the day before it was released for some odd reason, and I have never had this problem. I can duplicate the problem if I hold it that way, but I've never dropped a call, I've never had slow data, I've never had a problem because of it. So, you know, what do you think of those numbers and just the general feeling around this whole thing?
Well, the testing that I saw that Anantech did, that you have here, and it confirms the testing I've seen elsewhere, that, you know, I mean, if you look at there's a column here called cupping tightly, so you're holding the phone very tightly. This is not something you would do under the course of normal use, but it's a solid 10 dB below the iPhone 3GS. So that tells me that in the worst case scenarios, the antenna design is definitely worse. In the worst case scenario,
most definitely putting it on the outside, giving it complete contact with your skin, bad move. You know,
right now, the other one that's interesting, though. I mean, holding on the palm on an open palm. So this is not, you know, not cupping it, not touching. Yeah,
your skin is not coming in contact with the antenna.
It's still 9 dB. Well, almost 10 dB less. And in the case, and once you put it in a case, it's 4 dB less than the iPhone 3. or for 3GS. So it's definitely worse across the board. The attenuation's worse. But if you translate that, you know, down to the chart where they list the bars, you know, 10 dB when you're at the 3-bar level is going to put you down into the 1-bar level now, even with the new software.
Yeah, so here's how you guys can't see this, but there's an article on AnonTech. There's two articles, actually. One that says what iOS 4.0.1 is going to do to change the way bars are displayed. And then there's another article where they actually did testing and made some graphs to show you at what dBm rating the bars show up. Like, if you have 1 bar on your phone, what's the dBm rating for that 1 bar? If you have 2 bars, what's the dBm rating? And we have these in front of us now that we're looking at. And there are two things that I saw from this chart. First thing is that all cell phones except the iPhone 4 running the new OS, their algorithms are not as sensitive. What I mean by that is that the sensitivity goes from negative 51 decibels down to negative 113 decibels. Whereas with the new version of iOS, the sensitivity goes the whole way down to negative 121. So what that tells me is that on, you know, Froyo phones, Android phones, on the older version of the iPhone running a version 4.0 or less, their algorithms, you would get a no service signal once your cell phone detected less than 113 decibels, because that is below the 1-bar setting. Mm-hmm. Whereas Apple has now figured out with their new algorithm, that's not necessarily the case. We don't want to kill the service because we found out that we can get service the whole way down to 121. So that's the first thing that I saw, that they increase the sensitivity. The second thing is that if you go to AnonTech and look at this chart, the way they work out the bars now is more even. So the iPhone has a 5-bar system. There are 5 bars on the top of the phone. And you would think that if it's going to be even, each bar would represent 20% of your signal. Well, previously, this was not the case at all. Previously, in order to get 5 bars, all you had to have was better than 49% signal. So compare this to taking a test in school. You scored a 49% on your test, and your teacher gives you a 100% A, a 100% A. That is essentially what happens with every other smartphone on the planet with their algorithm. You can have less than half of a signal, and your phone will tell you you are perfectly fine with full bars.
Well, I think we have to be careful about saying that like, most phones put their 5-bar signal, at least in the 3G world, because it could be different in the GSM world. But negative 89 dB is where that's the threshold for, you know, maybe a full data rate connection. Meaning, I don't know this, but let's just assume that, you know, AT&T must set some standard that you have to be able to hit the negative 89 dB or negative 90 roughly.
Yeah, and Apple has said that their previous version was based on AT&T's standard of, you know, how to calculate the bars.
Right.
So they were following the standard.
Right. So that's fine. I mean, I'm not blaming Apple for that, but I think we have to be careful by saying that you only have 49% of your signal. You have 49% of your measurable signal, okay? Meaning that, you know, from negative 89 to negative 51, which is the top end of all of these, it's always going to report 4 bars or 5 bars, I guess.
Whatever the most is you have.
Whatever the most is you have, okay? So just because, you know, I don't think the example of getting 49% of the questions right and getting an A is correct, because I would say that anything above the negative 89 threshold is like extra credit, because a signal can be always be not infinitely, but much more powerful than you need to receive at a full data rate. And it above, they all seem to cap out at negative 51, and just knowing a little bit about RF propagation and that sort of thing, negative 51 dB at distance would be really good for a wireless signal, because the signal RF signal falls off with falls off at a rate of 6 dB per doubling of the distance away from the source. Okay, so if I'm 2 miles away and my signal is negative 70, when I go to 4 miles away, between 2 and 4 miles away, I'm only going to drop another 6 dB. Okay, so I think you have to take that in consideration with these numbers.
It would be nice if we knew that number. You know, that would have been something I should have looked up beforehand.
So like the threshold.
Yeah.
To get full. Yeah. Now, whether or not negative 89, or in the case of the Android signal bar mapping, or a negative 91 in the case of the iPhone 4.0 mapping, means that it gets full data rate, I don't know. But the interesting thing is that they moved that up to negative 76. So that tells me that maybe the iPhone can't get a full data rate connection at negative 90. It actually needs negative 76.
So you're thinking this is the exact opposite of the way I explained it, where you're showing a problem with the antenna, that it needs more signal to get higher speed.
Exactly. What this translates to, if you look at the chart, the other test they did, you know, there's pretty much across the board, from the 3GS at least, a good 10 to 20 dB drop. The one that's most egregious is the holding naturally. Holding the phone naturally, the 3GS to iPhone 4 drop is almost 20 decibels. That is huge. 20 decibels, that would be like going three times as far away from the tower as you were with the 3GS.
And in the case of the new bar system, that would almost be losing 2 or 3 bars.
Yeah, exactly. So I still think that this antenna design is, you know, it's questionable how well, you know, if the phone can maintain a connection, it can still work fine. But if you need to get a full data rate connection, and I'm not a expert on GSM, I don't know how exactly everything works. Like I believe that at scale, you're going to get more errors when you have a worse signal to noise ratio. So
right.
That would tell me that your data rate, your hard data rate, like the actual physical data rate, would probably remain the same, but more of those may be errors.
And that's really what these bars are. Like, the bars aren't just your signal strength. They're a combination of signal strength and the forward error correction ratio. So, yeah, the farther away you get, the worse your signal is, the noisier, the more errors your phone has to fix with the data that comes.
Yeah. The other interesting thing is they've extended the one bar down to negative 121. I've seen with most phones that if you're in the one bar, if you're fluctuating in and out of one bar or even just solid one bar, you're really lucky to be able to make a phone call. It may maintain a phone call if you go through an area for a short period of time, but it seems like to make a phone call or to start a data connection, it has a hard time. At least it does on Verizon. I don't have a lot of experience on AT&T.
Yeah, for me, there are a lot of times when I'm holding the phone that I'll see it down at one bar. And like I said, I haven't had a problem yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe it's just because I haven't tried to start a call at one bar. You know, I don't look at the bars every time I start a call, so I don't know.
Right. Well, what I was getting at is that the bars only tell you what, you know, your signal receiving, okay? That doesn't mean that your phone can contact the tower. So if the antenna has to transmit too, and that's where a lot of the problem may reside. If you've reduced the transmit power of the phone by 20 decibels, and it's only got a couple watt transmitter, I think they're like maybe 2 watts or something like that on the, and it might even be less than that.
Yeah, honestly. I'm not sure.
You know, that's like going from, if you go 20 decibels down, that's like going from, if you had started with, say 2 watts, it would be like going, wattage is a, every power doubling is 3 dB. Okay. So, there'd be 1, 2, 3, 6, be cut 2 watts in half 6 times. That's how much attenuation you get from the transmit power as well. So this problem, I think, is bigger than Apple wants to let on. You know, if you're in areas of strong coverage, if you're up in the negative 70s, negative, you know, or higher, it may not be a problem. But in areas of weak coverage, it's a huge problem.
Right. Yeah, and that's what one of the things that Steve Jobs brought up during his press conference. He's like, you know what? It seems to be in weak spaces. And if you do live in one of those spaces, bring it back in. We'll give you a full refund.
Yeah.
You know, no restocking fee. And, you know, so do that.
Right. But, I mean, the way Apple played this off.
Oh, it was wrong. The way they handled it first.
Yeah. I think it was wrong. I mean, that you know, kind of leads into this other article. There's an article from, I think it was from Electronista. Electronista.com about, you know, RIM basically saying that this, you know, them playing this off on and saying, oh, it's a problem with every phone, isn't really true. They, you know, all these companies invest a lot of money in the antenna design. And I think that, you know, in the case of most phones, they put the antenna probably, I don't know, I've never really dissected many of them, but I've seen a lot of them, they have a sticker near the top of the phone. It'd say on the back usually, don't put your hand here. And the problem with the iPhone is that you can't really not hold it anywhere without touching the antenna first. And if you bridge that gap...
I can, but...
Well, no, you're still touching the antenna.
Oh, yeah, I'm touching the antenna. I'm just not bridging the gap.
Right. Well, and any physical contact with the antenna is going to change its properties, you know. So it could affect the reception, but... specifically the way that gap is positioned on the iPhone, I think is really a mistake. If they would have made that gap at the very top of the phone, they may not have a problem at all.
Right. Why would you not put it somewhere where somebody's not going to touch?
Right.
You know?
And they called out that fact that here's where it's at, you know, so it's like putting a bullseye on the problem.
That was exactly what Steve said during the interview press conference. He's like, one of our biggest mistakes was putting an X marks the spot on where the antenna meets normal metal on the phone and telling people, hey, touch it here.
Yeah. I think that, you know, it may be that they don't have as many problems as that this would evidently seem to point that they would. But I think using the statistics that provided by AT&T may be a little bit unreliable in the sense that I think the majority of the iPhone 4 adopters were probably in large metropolitan areas or suburb areas that are well-to-do, that have very good phone coverage, and aren't in rural areas, not necessarily like our area, but, you know, somewhere 20 miles outside the city center or more, you know, 30, 40 miles.
Farmland,
exactly, along highways and that sort of thing. I'd like to see, you know, when it first came out, Jimmy Fallon of the Late Show or the Late Night Show on NBC reported that He had repeatedly had drop calls on the iPhone 3G going through the tunnel, the famous tunnel in
Liberty Tunnel or Lincoln Tunnel.
Lincoln Tunnel, I think, in New York City.
Yeah.
But when he got the iPhone 4, it held the call the whole way to the studio. But we're talking about New York City, you know, where there's lots of cell signal. I'd like to see someone drive on the turnpike through Pennsylvania and see
Fort Pitt Tunnel
and see if they can maintain that signal the entire way, because I'm skeptical given the attenuation, you know, although you shouldn't be holding your cell phone.
Right. Bluetooth headset.
Yeah. Bluetooth headset when you're driving.
Yeah. So, to get the new bars, you know, the way we were talking about that, you know, Apple is quote unquote fixed the way the bars display, that's in iOS 4.0.1. So that was out since Thursday. So go get that. And I'll tell you, it does make a difference in the way the bars show. My phone used to always show full coverage, 5 bars in Johnstown. And now I rotate between 3 and 4. So it does show a difference. It, you know, clearly they fixed something because they were really overestimating your signal. So they did at least take care of that. But the last article to talk about is about Apple's testing facilities and how they test the antennas for their phone. And this is an article from TechCrunch. If you go there, search for Inside Apple's Actual Distortion Field, and you'll find pictures of their testing facilities. Really creepy stuff. Looks like it's from a sci-fi movie. But I didn't want to talk about how they test them. What I wanted to talk about was some things that these reporters heard while they were there. The first one being that the iPad had been in testing in this facility, quote-unquote, 4 years. So that goes to show that, you know, even though we only heard about the iPad in the past couple months, maybe the past year, Apple has had this thing built and working for at least 2 years, maybe 3 or 4. And they also said that the iPhone 4 specifically has been in these anechoic chambers tested for 2 years. So that means in 2008, the iPhone 4 was a finished, ready-to-go product that they were testing in these chambers. And the reporter who wrote this article, you know, he started thinking, he's like, this is weird because they had stuff under black cloaks in there that we couldn't see. So I'm pretty sure that the iPhone 5 was right beside me, and so was the iPhone 6. You know, so this is just something kind of cool to think about. You know, no conspiracy theories here, but, you know, it seems that judging from what Apple said and what these people saw who took a tour of the test chambers, you know, Apple probably already has the next two revisions of the iPhone done and in testing. And hopefully they have the antenna not the way it is now.
Yeah. Well, you know, with respect to the iPad, if you remember at the All Things D conference, Steve Jobs mentioned that he started out with the iPad as the first iteration and set it aside to do the iPhone.
I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah. It was one of the things he talked about, that, you know, he started with the iPad when they got the idea to do it. And because there's also that famous interview from, like, 2007, I think, or somewhere around that time frame, where they have Steve Jobs and Bill Gates on the same stage, and they start talking about platforms and how, you know, Bill Gates envisioned this tablet platform that will be your main competing device and that sort of stuff. But and that he may have given the idea for a tablet and how popular it could be.
Steve probably thought, ooh, I'm going to do that.
Right. So if you work out the timing, it may have been that they started to work on the iPad at that time and then set it aside to do the iPhone, because the iPhone came out what year was it? 07?
07, yeah.
Yeah. Well, then that would mean he would probably start, if there's any truth to his story, if he started the iPad first, he probably would have started it in the mid-2000s, 2004, 2005.
Right, yeah. So that just points to, you know, what we can probably see in the future.
Yeah.
You know, they probably have some really cool stuff waiting to go.
Yep.
Hopefully they don't have another Gray Powell incident where somebody takes it out and loses it and it hits the news organizations. And that's something that I just want to say real quick to all of those people who make Photoshop, you know, concept images of, oh, this is the next iPhone. Please stop. If you would just stop doing that and making fake images, we would be 100% certain that when we see a leaked image of an iPhone or an iPad or any product hit the internet, that it is the real thing. You know, now we're thinking, oh, this is just a Photoshop. You know, this isn't real. But if you idiots out there would stop doing that, the next picture we see would be the real thing. And we wouldn't have to wonder whether it's real or not. We would know for a fact. So I know none of you who do this are listening to this show, but, you know, pass it around if you do listen. If you know somebody who makes these images, smack them upside the head. Anyways, that's my rant. And that is all we have for this episode of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Twitter and Facebook. My username is Slongcack. You can find Ryan also on Twitter and Facebook. His username is Ryan Lancey. And I'm very happy that we got some other people submitting articles to the show for this week. So if you would like to submit articles for us to comment on for the next show, tag them on Delicious, Slongcast011 for episode 11, which will be happening next. And hopefully we can get to your article and make you happy, because we love our listeners. Our viewership or listenership is steadily climbing, so tell your friends, get the word out there, and have a great Monday night, everybody.